We're gonna do Proverbs chapter 19, verse 24, and there are different ways of reading the verse. There's different commentaries that read the verse differently. We're going to go according to one commentary of the Meiri. Meiri was a medieval commentary, and he had a few ways of reading the verse. And one of the ways is he read it like this: a lazy person hides his hand in his pocket, and also to its mouth it does not return. What he learns mouth is to the mouth of the pocket. It goes back to the, because it doesn't say what mouth. Usually you would think it means our mouth. But he says one of the possibilities is that the mouth goes back to the beginning of the verse, to the pocket, that he puts his hand in his pocket. In other words, like this. A lazy man is the type of person that puts his hands in his pocket. He never takes it out. He's even too lazy to take it out. Can anybody tell me what that means? He himself says that that's, of course, an exaggeration. He's absolutely crazy. A person keeps his hands in his pocket and never takes it out. That can't be literal. Okay? So, therefore, there is some idea. In other words, according to the Meiri, this verse is saying an unbelievable and exaggeration that the lazy person puts his hand in his pocket and he'll never take it out, as an exaggeration to get across a certain idea about the lazy person. Question: why is it that why does the person put his hand in his pockets? And we're not talking about we need something from there. Why does the person keep his hands in his pocket in general? A person does that is because he keeps it there for comfort. It's a comfortable way of keeping it in. Feel comfortable, like a relaxing way. Okay? So what I think the Meiri is saying about a lazy person is a lazy person only looks for comfort. So he's looking for the comfortable life. Like a lazy person, even in his pleasures, like skiing, well, you got to drive out there, and then you got to get it on, and you go down, and you have to wait online. That's so much work. You know what I mean? Like the lazy person, the nature of the lazy person is that he goes towards the that a lazy person that he procrastinates means that he doesn't want to do that what he's obligated to do. But however, over here, but the thing is, the reason why he doesn't do what he's obligated to do, because he can't, it's too much of a bother, even in his own life. He's too lazy to eat, not that he's too lazy, that's the nature of the lazy person, to go out of his way for his pleasures. Therefore, he's drawn to the comfortable and non-active way, like a couch potato, that a person just sits and I mean, like if you like a person like he watches TV and then during the break he forces himself up to get something out of the refrigerator and flops back somehow and that's it. You see? But that's his lifestyle. That is the lazy person. His lifestyle is towards comfort and non-activity. Rest of the verse is usually you think of a lazy person that he doesn't do his responsibility, you see. But it's what the verse is saying, according to the Meiri, is that his very nature is he only goes for comfort. No, as long as he doesn't have to move too much, just keeps his hands in his pocket, he's a happy guy. But to get involved, I mean, to go for a walk or to take a bike out, I mean, all the complications, that's too much already, so he can't do it. He only moves towards the life of comfort. But we never think of a lazy person as evil. That happens to be true. It's not that he's evil, but he's harmful to himself. He can't really go out and enjoy life because he can't move himself. He can't even get himself to enjoy his own pleasures. You know what I mean? So therefore, he moves back to the... Because he can't get involved to activity, so he just moves back to his the most comfortable of anything and least resistance. He moves to the least resistance. So the greatest harm is to himself. And of course he can't get the knowledge of God. He won't go in that way. He won't come to any truths because he can't be bothered. It's too much of a bother. Can't do it. I mean, I just can't do it. That's it. So therefore he will not get any place. But See, there are many verses in Proverbs that tell us that he procrastinated because his procrastination in different ways, how he's harming himself, and they tell many different ways, the way he harms himself because he doesn't do what's necessary for him to do. But what this verse is saying, according to the Meiri, is something, a new point, and that is that his whole life is always for the comforts of life. Now, as long as he doesn't have to move, that's it. Keep his hand in his pocket, and that's a comfortable thing. You see? Most he'll do is he'll force himself up to the refrigerator if he can't get there. That's it. Then flop back on the couch. That's basically what it is.
Okay.
Well, Proverbs, it says this guy's going to fail. I mean, because if you don't take on your responsibilities and see what has to be done, of course you're going to fail. But what the verse is saying is that the lazy person has a certain state of mind, a certain view of the world. Like wherever there's an exertion that is necessary, then that thing is of no value. There's no value if you can exert yourself. It's of no value. Can't be an enjoyment if you exert yourself. So he just backs off, and that's it. It's a certain state of mind, you see. So that's what this verse is saying. Not the failure that he'll fail. That's many verses talk about the lazy person's failures. On the methodology over here. Usually when we deal in Proverbs, we always find two opposites. We always find the wicked and the righteous, or the wise and the fool. Okay, so we always have two different contrasts. Over here, there doesn't seem to be any contrast. It's only talking about one type of person. The answer is that sometimes, it happens a few times, not too often, he only speaks about one side and leaves the contrast to you. Okay? In other words, that you should work out the opposite. Be an energetic person. And he's when he has a desire, he's not lazy about doing it or carrying it out. And so, therefore, that would be the opposite, right? The opposite person would be an energetic person. I'm not talking about energetic towards evil, but energetic to do either an enjoyment or something that is just or correct. That would be the other side of it. Okay? Opposites, but we know whenever we have opposites, like, for instance, hot, warm, and cold, so you say, if we ask what's the subject, you would say temperature, right? So the same thing here, if we have two opposites, then there should be one subject that we're comparing them to. So the question is, we have the person that only looks for the life of comfort and is not energetic, and the opposite is the energetic person that whenever he has a desire, assuming it's not evil, so then he's not lazy about doing it. He just goes out and does it. Okay, so now what is the subject of the verse? The subject is that there's two personalities or two lifestyles. That's what it is. One lifestyle is an energetic lifestyle where a person has desires and he goes out to get what he wants. Okay, that's an energetic lifestyle. There's another lifestyle that is totally passive or comfort-sinking, you see? That is just simply, I think, going any further than this is not part of the subject of the verse. All we could see from the verse is that there's two types of lifestyles. That's what I think the verse is saying. Then something stopped him. I'm going to do Psalm 121. The first verse says, I lift up my eyes to the hills, from where help will come. The psalm was written in a situation where, like a hopeless situation. Okay? Now, when a person is in a hopeless situation, what they do is most of the times they fantasize for a certain type of security. Like in the over here, it's they're in a siege situation, and it's absolutely hopeless. So they look up to the hills and they start thinking there's going to be an army, help is on the way, when really there is absolutely no help. You see, so that's the situation. A person, it could be a disease, it could be anything, where a person is in like a hopeless situation and he starts fantasizing different types of help that can come. verse sets up the situation in which the psalm is written, and that is a hopeless situation. King David says, "My help comes from the Lord, who made heaven and earth." Commentary the Radak, also the Meiri, writes, what it means is that when a person knows that God created the heaven and earth, but not only that he created it, but that he recognizes the system of the physical world, and he sees that God had to be a creator via the system. Okay? So, now, the thing is, that's what the verse is talking about. Now, the thing is that in Judaism, we don't use the word philosophy. Usually we talk about philosophy, that these are philosophical ideas. Judaism, they use the term hashkafa. Hashkafa means a viewpoint, certain view. Now, the thing is that what he's saying, from the relationship from the first verse to the second verse, is that when we start out and we're in a terrible situation, like we can't get out of, so right away we start fantasizing. That's the way people usually do it. An infantile view, like somehow help will come. But however, we have to change our view that the only real source of help is God. That's the only real source of help. But that source of help, that you really rely and depend on that source of help, only comes by a change of your view, and that change of view comes by understanding that God created the world. By knowing, via the knowledge of the world, where you see God's wisdom in the world, you see, so there comes a change in your view and the way you view the world. Okay? Now, this change in view could come from many situations. Bach Yevon Pekuda, in his book Duties of the Heart, says that even man-made things, you could see God. Why? Because all man-made things that are really successful is only after you see the science of how it works. You see? As you see how the physical world works, so then you could create new things. So you're really learning God's system, because all that wisdom that he allowed you to see, and from there create new things from God's system, so you see God's wisdom there. The Ibn Ezra says that you could see God's wisdom in the animals, the way they operate, and well, a weak animal in terms of danger, or any of the animals, how they operate, you see a system of wisdom, which is definitely not the animal's wisdom, but it is God's wisdom. And again, Bachya talks about the human being. From you understand the workings of the human being, you can see God in all these areas of wisdom, you see. Now, as you start seeing these areas of wisdom, you see, then you start relating to God through his wisdom, and then you have a better understanding of how God relates to the physical world. Is that many times we see man created things that just came about by accident, right? The answer is that there are many, many accidents that happen that people don't realize their significance. But it's usually a wise and intelligent person, when the accident happens, that he knows how to interpret the incident so that he can make use of it, you see? But if we're not wise, then we see these accidents, then we go back to our infantile view and start saying, oh, look at this magical thing, or whatever, however we view this through our emotions. So then again, we don't see it through the rational ideas, and you don't see it through God's system, but you just see it via your own infantile view of the world. Start seeing about the different, you even on TV or whatever you read, you see different areas of science. So after, now the thing is, up until now, if you enjoyed that type of thing, so it'd be an interesting thing. But however the Torah, the philosophical part of Torah was written, how to view the world. So therefore what the Psalms is telling you now is how to view the information that you get from different areas of science, and how you could actually see God's wisdom in all this area, and therefore see God through the through God's creation. That's why it says, I turn to God, the creator of the world, who made the world, you see? And through his world, when I see his world and his system, that's how I understand. From his system, I understand how God relates to me, and then I understand how to relate to God. But many scientists just look at it as a science, and they don't recognize they don't allow themselves to recognize that there has to be a creator, and it's really God's system that they're actually seeing. And they close that off for different reasons. But however, King David is teaching us how to view the physical world so that we could recognize different areas, and so to change and to move from our infantile view to the correct view of viewing the physical world. Verse 3 says, he will not allow your foot to falter, and he who guards you will not slumber. Now the question is, what is the connection between these two statements? Between your foot slipping and God not slumbering. Slumbering means to doze, like a nap. It's not a deep sleep, it's a nap. That's what the word slumber means. Okay? Slumber means that at that moment he is not aware of, and he cannot help you during that time that he slumbers. That he dozes, he's not aware of you, and he does not, and he can't help you. Here is that there is no lapse in God's providence or guidance or watching of the physical world. Now, the smallest catastrophe and the shortest catastrophe that a person could probably have is he slips. It takes a few seconds. That's it, you slip. That's the smallest catastrophe that you can have. It is even that amount that there is no lapse in God's providence over the physical world. This is how the Matsudas David interprets the verse, and that this knowledge you will see that it has to be so as a result of your study of God's world. In other words, when you study God's world, you will also see this idea that there cannot be any lapse. In other words, it's not a matter of believing or feeling God with me all the time, but it's a matter of knowing that through the universe you could see that there can be no lapse in God's relationship to the physical world. I mentioned that just as you see in all the laws of nature, that it never lapses, like you never see that suddenly the law of gravity suddenly stops for a minute and you start floating. There is no stop in the system, in God's system, the way it works, so you must know that there is no stop in God's relationship to the physical world. You see that there is no lapse in the laws of nature, then as you continue studying, then you'll see that there can't be a lapse in God's providence and his awareness of what is happening in the physical world. The question is it possible that God set the laws in motion and then he left? Yes, there's always that possibility, but what King David is saying here is that when you study the world through the eyes of this viewpoint, of the viewpoint of Psalms, then you will see that even God's providence is an impossibility for it to lapse. In other words, God's providence is just as much a part of the laws of nature as the laws of nature themselves. It is a system that actually operates. And once you see that system in operation, then you will see that there can't be a lapse. I'm not proving that it is so. I'm only saying what King David says you will see if and when you study the universe and you start seeing God's providence in the physical world, you will also see, just like the laws of nature can't, there's no lapse in the laws of nature, so there will be no lapse in God's providence in his relationship to you. the difference between how, on what basis the laws of nature work based on, as you well know, the laws of nature, and it doesn't recognize who you are. It doesn't recognize if you're good or bad, it just works. However, the system of providence operates based on who you are, based on good and evil, or based on your relationship to Torah. So if you have a certain relationship to Torah, so then good things will happen to you. If you have you're bad, then bad things, or for whatever reason, but it's based on a system of good and evil. And it's a moral and ethical system that operates in the physical world. 4 says, behold, he who guards Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. Okay? Now both the Radak and the Ibn Ezra say that it's the long, in other words, doze is, like we said before, slumber is a short-term lapse. That we would think that's what it means, that there's a lapse. Sleep means is that there's a long lapse. Okay? Now, what he's saying is here is sometimes there's a short lapse, which it's really, like we said before, there is no lapse. But however, it seems to us like a lapse, you see? And sometimes it's so long we think God went to sleep. In other words, what we mean by sleep, that God's providence has been removed. Like, for instance, in the last 2,000 years, insofar as Israel is concerned, it was basically a catastrophe. But even more so, so far as the whole world is concerned, it was also a catastrophe because basically evil ran the world. It was run by... It was only small times when there was any type of area that was run by some type of system of justice. There was a rare case that you found a system of justice, some type. So the thing is that in that type of situation, many times a person could say that God is not relating to me. It's a strong emotion that sometimes, sometimes something, for some people, it's a short thing. Small thing happens, a catastrophe happens, and where's God? Person says. But when you see over 2,000 years and you just, it looks like hopeless. It looks like God is sleeping. It seems like a long lapse. You see? Now, the thing is that when we say that there's a... Now, you have to understand, this chapter was saying that we turn to God in a situation where there's a problem. Yet we just showed where sometimes it seems hopeless and it ends hopelessly. For 2,000 years, there are a lot of people that died in hopeless situations. So the question is, how do I relate? In other words, I'm praying to God for help, and I really don't see help. So how do I relate? Okay? You understand? In other words, if I'm praying to God for help, then I expect some help. But if I look over the last 2,000 years, there wasn't too much help. So the question is, how do I relate to God insofar as these 2,000 years are concerned in my own personal life if I don't see it? Is that there is a medrash that says that when Abraham started relating to the true God, so of course he was in opposition with the state God. And so therefore the king Nimrod built the fire and says, either you retract or in you go. And Abraham would not retract, and he was thrown into the fire, and of course he was saved. Now standing in the background was Abraham's brother, Nahor. And he said like this. He says, if Abraham dies, then forget it, I don't accept that God. If he lives, so then that God will save me, so then fine, I'll accept that God. So we saw when Abraham was saved, so then they asked him, well, which God do you hold from? He says, well, I hold from the God of Abraham. So he was thrown into the fire and he died. Okay? So the Ramban asks, what's the difference? Okay? The answer is that Abraham made his decision to accept God no matter what happens. If God helps him or if something good happens, fine. But if not, that would not affect his view of God. You see? In other words, there's a certain reality that sometimes, for some reason, it doesn't work. See, also by Rabbi Akiva, he was tortured to death, and he accepted God totally, 100%, despite the fact that he was tortured, you see? So the question is, again, so then, where's my security? How do I relate to God? I think the formula is we find in Samuel 2, chapter 12, and verse 14. This is when Natan the Navi, the prophet, came and told King David that he sinned, and King David accepted that he sinned, and then he says that God will forgive him, but he has to be punished. But this child that Bathsheba is bearing because of their relationship, that child is going to die. Now, and so it happened that the child got very sick, okay? And it says that even though King David knew it was a prophecy, he still turned to God. And he prayed and he fasted. And he was fasting so much that the elders of Israel tried to take him away, try to get him to eat. And he refused. He wouldn't even talk to them. This went on for around 7 days, and they didn't know what to do. But in 7 days, the child died. Okay? And they saw how broken he was when the child was sick, so they're afraid to speak to him. But he saw from their quietness, he sensed that what happened. So he asked him, did the child die? And he said, yes. They told him, yeah, the child died. So what did he do? In verse 20 it says, King David got up from the ground, and he washed, changed his clothing, came to the house of God, and bowed down to God. His wish definitely didn't come true, but he bowed down to God, came into his house, and he asked for food, and they gave him food and ate. You see? In other words, the formula is in reality, the only source of help in reality is from God. If you're in a situation, like I said before, that we're talking about a situation where it's hopeless, and the laws of nature will not help you, unless you're in fantasy world. So the thing is, the only thing you could do is turn to the source of all reality, that the God that created the world, and he could change the laws of nature, you must turn to him. But if God decides not to help, for whatever reason, then you must still bow down to God and accept reality for what it is. A certain acceptance of reality. And always know, by acceptance of reality, I mean to be aware that God did not lapse. There was no lapse of God's providence. There's no lapse in God's relationship, even though it's for 2,000 years, that you see the world totally guided by evil, then you must know that this is God's will or God's plan, whatever it is. We must know that we must accept God for his sake. It's a different view of how most people relate to religion. Most people relate to religion, what could God do for me? If God doesn't do it, then, well, that's it, goodbye. God is, in other words, God is not here. God doesn't do it for me, God is not here. We don't look at it that way. We must know without a doubt, through this view of reality, that there is never, it's not a belief, it must be a knowledge for you to be able to handle it, that you know without a doubt that there can't be a lapse of God's providence. Once you recognize that there can't be a lapse of God's providence, then you recognize that God is always there. And if this is the will of God, then I accept the will of God. That is my relationship to God, my acceptance of his will. You see? So therefore, I mean, if we just go over this chapter in other words, what we're saying is that there must be a study of God's universe and realize he's the creator. Then you must recognize God's providence, and there's never a lapse in his providence. And no matter what, whether it's a short catastrophe or a long catastrophe, you have to know that for some reason there is no help, then you must know it's God's will, so therefore you must accept God's will for whatever it may be. The rest of the chapter talks about the different situations that God protects us. The Lord is your guard. The Lord is your shade upon your right hand. Right hand represents like a fighter, a warrior. So it's a situation of war. And a shade that covers you totally, you see. So God is like the shade that is constantly over you in a situation of war. And this idea of shade will follow through in all the other verses too. The sun shall not smite thee by day, nor the moon by night. What that means, the sages say, I mean, the Ibn Ezra says it definitely, and others say it, practically all the commentaries say that the sun is a good thing, but yet too much sun is no good. He says the night is a good thing, but there's a lot of dampness at night. That's too much dampness is also not good. So the very laws of nature that are good for you, sometimes too much of a good thing. So therefore, God, when you're under God's providence, then God will protect you from the very laws of nature, from the excess of the laws of nature, which has to, in other words, the laws of nature operate, and sometimes it's too much for the human being. So God will protect you against all areas of the laws of nature that will do harm to you, the excess. You see? So the Lord shall preserve thee from all evil. He shall preserve thy soul. What it means is that from all evil means from outside of you. There are problems outside of you, and there are problems from within. So he says that God will help you from outside, from within, from all different areas. And then it says the Lord shall protect your going out and your coming in. Going out, all the sages say, if you're talking about Israel, then going out into the exile. In other words, God is there even when you're going out to exile, and God will be there when they bring you back into exile. And if you're talking about the personal, so then whenever you go out into a situation of danger, you should know God is there. And when you come back, if you're protected, then God is there. In all situations, everything is guided by God. Everything is ruled by God's system. And he says, from this time forth and forevermore, meaning that God's providence and will be on the world forever. In other words, that will never be removed. Doing Proverbs chapter 22, verse 1. And we're doing this according to the Ibn Ezra and the Matsudas David. Okay, we're going to do verse 1 and verse 2. It says, it is better to have a good name than a lot of wealth, and silver and gold than good grace. And the second verse says, wealth and poverty meet. God made them both. The translation of the first was off, and that is that the good grace is better than silver and gold. Define is what is a good name and what is a grace. How does he get a name and what is grace? Now, sages say that the name comes from good actions. When you do good actions, so people will say, hey, that's a nice guy. Grace means where people are drawn to you. Yeah. Grace, usually when a person has grace, is like people are drawn to you. Why are people drawn to you? So people are drawn to you. People have negative emotions. And you'll notice sometimes when you meet somebody, you immediately feel comfortable with them or you feel uncomfortable with them, and the question is why do you feel that way with different people? The answer is your unconscious picks up from their unconscious, and therefore if you pick up negative emotions, sometimes you feel uncomfortable. Let's say they look down on you. You might not be able to define it, but when you come in their presence, you feel uncomfortable. So that's grace. Grace means no negative emotions. You don't have to, when the Torah talks about it, it means that you removed your negative emotions, and correct actions come from thought, where you think it through, and that this is the correct action. So therefore, these two things are, in other words, so grace represents where you remove negative emotions. And a good name means that you have thought, because you worked out, you do correct actions, which take thought. So you have correct thought, in the verse, and you have the removal of negative emotion. That's really a perfection of a person according to Torah. Now, that's better than silver and gold, okay? I mean that when people are drawn to you, they're drawn to you because you don't have the negative emotions. That's why grace means they're drawn to you, and we're giving the reason that they don't have these negative emotions. According to the commentaries, the second verse is given the reason why you should choose a good name and grace over silver and gold, because says a rich man and a poor man meet. What does it mean they meet? Is because God, it comes from a decree of God, that God decreed on them that, you know, that they should be wealthy or poor. In other words, it is God that made them, meaning is in their case, that case of wealth and poverty is decreed by God, is made by God, that you should, whether you should be rich or poor is decreed by God. But however, a good name and grace, that's really part of your free will, okay? And free will, God doesn't interfere with. That you do totally on your own. It says, our sages say, everything is from heaven except the fear of heaven. Okay? In other words, anything that you have that comes from God is decreed by God except the fear of God. And the fear of God really is your thinking, your training to think, the thought, plus the removal of negative emotions. That's where God cannot intervene. Okay? So if that is true, so therefore you can take pride in that. You should choose to work on these two things, because that's something you could say, I did it. It's you that did it. While the money, it's not in your hands how much money you're going to make. Question is that we see practically that people who work make money, and people who don't work, that are lazy, don't make money. Not only that, even in Proverbs it says the lazy man will not benefit. And in other words, if he's right? And if a person sits around and even studies Torah all day or prays all day, I mean, he's not going to make money. So, and even in Proverbs it says everything in its correct time. A person should study, a person should work. So the thing is, the question is if I understand sometimes a person works, he might not get money, he might not make it, because of outside circumstances. But however, if you don't work, you're certainly not going to make money. The question is, yeah, but even if you don't work, you could win a lottery. The answer is a rational person, and definitely the Torah would not advise a person to sit back and not work and rely on a lottery to make a living. I mean, that would not be a rational thing to do. It would not be an intelligent thing to do. But yet, even though we have this question, on the other hand, the Torah does say, sages say, that everything is from heaven except the fear of heaven. So the question is, we have a problem on our hands. Fear of heaven, it means free will. That's free will. Okay? I relate the question like this, that if everything comes from heaven, then why should we work? And if I work, that proves that it doesn't come from heaven. So on the one hand, the Torah tells us that we should work. And on the other hand, they say everything comes from God. So how does this work out? The question is what does it mean everything comes from heaven? It means exactly that. I mean, anything that in your life is, all results are not in your hands, all circumstances are not in your hands. You were born, you know what I mean, your personality is not in your hands. That was given to you by, you know, your family, what country you were raised in as a personality. I mean, all these things are out of your hands, except the ability to change your personality. You have the ability to change it through study. So these things of whether God is going to save you or whether God is not going to save you. So all these things are according to the statement, is in the hands of God. God brings about results. God's going to save you or help you. So then this is in God's hands. All results, let's put it this way. All results are in God's hands. So you do all the actions, and then God will decide whether your actions will be fruitful or not. What we're saying now is that if you work, there's a certain probability that you will be, if you work correctly and not rely on winning a lottery, so the probability of you making it is greater than the probability if you're lazy and just do crazy things. So that we're agreeing on. But the only thing is that still in all, how can you reconcile the two statements that I have to work, that is a fact of life, that I have to do it correctly, act correctly and think it through in a correct manner to work and to be successful, that definitely the Torah holds from. Simultaneously, the Torah holds that the results are in God's hands, right? So the question is if the results are in God's hands, then why did God say that we should work? And if it's totally in our hands, so then why does it say it's in the result that the results are in God's hands? Broaden the question a little more. Like, for instance, we know that when God destroyed Haman, right? We know it was God's will. So then we'll ask the question there. So why did Esther work out such an elaborate plan to destroy Haman? Well, why'd she have to do that? She worked out a whole elaborate plan. In fact, her life was in danger to do this. The result is not in her hands anyway, so why should she do it? Okay? We know the Medrash that says that when Moses came down to the water, the Medrash says that Moses got down to pray, and God says, now's not the time to pray, now's the time to act. And then somebody jumped into the water, and he said, and he went up into his nose, and he says, God, one more step and I drown. And our sages says that's when God split the water. So what is our sages saying? That you're obligated to go to the very end, even where you're relying on miracles already. You still must do everything which is in human power to do, but the result, you know, you can't accomplish that result. You're relying on a miracle. You can't accomplish that result. That result is in the hands of God. So even there, you see, you must do everything in your possibility to do it. And why did Elijah have to go to Mount Carmel and perform all these miracles? God could have done it without him. Why do you need Elijah to do it? Why do you have to do it through Elijah?
Why didn't you just ask for...
In the prayers of Ashrei, the first verse, Ashrei, which we say three times a day in our prayers, it says, Ashrei Yoshvei Veisecha, happy is the man that dwells in your house. Now it's talking about happy is the man that dwells in your house. We're talking about a righteous person that's living in God's house. And in your house means your world. Some people interpret it as the temple. But however, your house could also mean this world. And the question is, everybody lives in God's world. This is the only world we have. Everybody's living here. So why are we only talking about the righteous that lives in your house? Okay? The answer is there's two ways of living in this world. Okay? One is correctly and one is incorrectly. I'll give an illustration. Let's say greed, which is one of the negative emotions. Okay? Greed is an incorrect view of relating to money. Okay? Why? Because what is money? Money is simply a very practical thing that I need to live. In other words, for instance, I need a house. So I have to make money to make a house and maintain a house. Food, clothing. But then again, I need certain luxuries. So I have to make a certain amount of money for the luxuries. Then I need a certain amount of money for security. So I need insurance. How much insurance is worked out by by different statistics of how much you need. Then how much you need the bank. Again, they work out statistics for practicality, what you need. Now, so therefore, after you get all this money for all your needs and for retirement, and you have all this money, there's a certain point where beyond that, it's irrational. Why are you making more? Let's say, for instance, we say, you need $1 million. I mean, take an extreme case. But 2 million you don't need, 5 million, 50 million. There's a point where it's irrational if it doesn't fit in practically with the practicality, you see. So therefore, greed is an incorrect view of money. Greed is saying that I must constantly be working to making more money, and no matter how much I have, I must continuously work for more. Which is irrational. Why should you have more? What is it going to do you? It has no value at all. The person that lives in God's house is the person that makes correct decisions. Okay? That is really where your free will is. Your decisions are going to be made. Person's decisions are based on his knowledge and his emotions. If he has negative emotions, then he'll make a decision to be greedy. Maybe not a conscious decision, but the decision of his life is to be greedy. Okay? If he doesn't have negative emotions, or if he does have and he makes a study of money, and what's the purpose of money and the value of money and how he should go about making money, so then that person will be guided by a rational view of making money. Okay? So the one that lives in God's house, what it means living in God's house, is the one that lives according to the way this world was made. In other words, in reality, money is only there only for practical reason. There is no other value in money except for practicality. If you raise it to a higher level than practicality, some other high level like greed or something else, so then you are not living. In other words, your view of money is not in God's world because it doesn't belong. It's a distorted view of God's world. So he who lives in God's house is, we're not saying the physical world, we all live in the physical world, but he who lives in God's house means he who makes his decisions by virtue of the what makes sense and not by his negative emotions that will make him, or even good emotions that's gone to extremes, okay? There's certain times where you go to an extreme. So in those cases, that is not living in God's world. Said that that free will is one of the things of free will is correct actions. Okay, part of free will is making a decision to do an act and then I do the act. Right? Okay. Now let's say, for instance, correct action. Now let's take this money that we said where we explain money and greed. So let's say, how should I now? I want to relate to money correctly. Okay. So there's two ways of relating to money, either through greed or through practicality. Look at a practical. Now, I see from God's world that, in other words, when I look at the world rationally, what God's created, I see that money only has a value insofar as practicality is concerned. Beyond that, it's satisfying some emotion, which doesn't make sense. Okay? So when I relate to money in the correct manner, right, it is then that I'm living in God's world. Is that correct? So therefore, when I analyze money and I say, well, I need this amount of money for security if something goes wrong, a catastrophe, so I need X amount of money in the, and I work it out rationally, how much in the bank, all these things, so then I am living in God's world. You see, because God wants me to live in his world, so I have to analyze his world. And these ideas, what I'm saying now, are all in Proverbs. These ideas, how to live practically in your everyday life, is in Proverbs. So, and even like Jacob, when he prepared to meet Esau, right? So it says he tried a peace treaty, then he separated his family. That was a plan for war, and then afterwards he prayed to God that one of those ways worked. Right? In other words, he did everything which was rational in this situation, which made sense in this situation, and then you turn to God, to pray to God that your plan worked. So when I'm doing these actions, it's true my mind is on the result, that I want to bring about a certain result, but that method that I use is a correct action. Because that's the will of God, that I should always act correctly, not according to my negative emotions, and not according to ignorance. Because those two things will definitely make you fail. That's what we said. We see that's not part of God's world. Part of God's world is to make sure you remove your negative emotions to be successful, and that you should have ideas. Thing is what you're doing, we said that's part of free will, is you're doing correct actions. See, in other words, the correct way of looking at life is always doing correct actions and making sure your actions are correct. In other words, let's say, for instance, you worked, you had a certain plan and you worked it out and then it failed. Okay? Now what you should do is go back and look over that plan and see, was there any mistake I made? Was it simply a logical mistake that I was ignorant of? Or did one of my emotions, my negative emotions, affect me in a certain way? If so, then I was the cause of the failure and I have to correct my emotions. But if I didn't do anything wrong, then I have to accept God's will of the results, because all I have to look at is not the results, but only whether I did correct actions. My responsibility in this world is to only look at correct actions. Results are not in my hands at all. To illustrate this idea, so that you can see it in a practical way, let's say, for instance, you come to a new city and you have to go from place A to place B. So you have a plan, you look up a map, and with the map you're able to figure out how to get there, so you have a plan. That's in your hands. But let's say, for instance, you get a flat tire, or the car breaks down. If it's something you knew about, then it's your fault. But if it's not, then it's out of your hands. So therefore, the thing is that whatever is in your plan that a person can see that must be a correct thing, a correct plan or correct strategy to get to his goal, that's within his free will. And that part is, if he makes a mistake, he'll have to accept fault. And if he creates the plan, whether it's successful or not, but it was a good plan, and if anything went wrong, it's not because of him. It was like an outside factor, like something went wrong with the car. So then he can't blame himself. He has to just accept that this is the way life is. But however, if it's within his plan that something went wrong, then he has to make sure he has to think over what the mistake was and why he made that mistake, and to make sure the next time he makes the plan not to make that type of mistake. Is that if you need the results, let's say, for instance, you need money, you must have that result, right? Now, if you don't get that result and no part of the plan was your fault, you see, then you have to accept that that's the will of God. This is the way God made the world. And that's the way it is, you see. But if you are successful because of the plan, then you can take credit for the plan and thank God that there was no outside factors that didn't come in to break the plan down. Say it is God's will. We do not mean God's will on a personal level, but we mean God's will on a global level. In other words, that's the way God created the laws of nature. And there is a certain amount of things that are outside of your control. Okay? But we do pray to God. The formula really was what Rashi says by Jacob. When Jacob went to meet Esau, so he sent them a peace treaty. He sent animals, different animals. That was a peace treaty. Then it says he divided the camp in two. So Rashi says that was a plan for war. It was a strategy of war to divide the camp. And then the third thing is that Jacob prayed, and that he prayed that he prayed that no outside factor should interfere so that his plan A or plan B should be successful. And that is the formula of all life. going to do chapter 22, verse 4. Okay? And the verse, now there are two different interpretations. Rashi gives two different interpretations, and we will take both, and it'll also change the translation, because one word could have two different translations. Okay? So we'll take those two. All right, it says, because of humility is the fear of God, wealth and honor and life. Deal with the first half of the verse, namely, because of humility is the fear of God. And we'll deal with that first with the two possibilities in Rashi before we get to the second half. And the question is, what is humility and how does it lead to the fear of God? And what is the fear of God that you need humility to lead you to the fear of God? Well, the usual view of humility is somebody with a poor self-image. Okay? Poor self-image comes about when a person has a view of what he should be, sometimes which is beyond reality, and that he cannot reach it. So he is, what happens is that he is trying to change himself to fit in to that level of ethics or morals or of some value system that is probably impossible for that person, for any human being. Some of these levels are impossible. But however, most people, when they see such a person, they think of them as having humility. That is not humility. It's really just one emotion controlling the other. However, the true view of humility is when you have the ability to change your emotions in line with reality. When you see the truth and your emotions come in line with reality. In other words, the difference between the two, both are forcing your life to live a certain life. Okay? But one is based on a conscience, some conscience that came about before you were aware of making decisions, and the other is a study of reality, and the reality affects your life. Fear of God comes about when you recognize, it's not really fear, I would say awe, when you recognize God's wisdom in the universe, and you're drawn to God as a result of that wisdom which you see of God. So therefore, a person has to start out, let's say a person starts out in everyday life, like he reads this study about how to make decisions in life, everyday life, the practical life, like Proverbs, like we deal a lot in Proverbs. Now, if that information that he gets becomes real to him, then when he starts studying about, he starts seeing God in the universe, in different areas of different areas, like we spoke before many times, we showed how you could see God in everyday life and in ecology, you know, all these things. So the thing is that as you start seeing God in these different areas, if you humility is where you have the ability, where your emotional view changes to that realistic view. Humility is the personal experience that a person gets as a result of his knowledge. The ideas are universal, that you could sit down and you could prove every step why this is true and you could show. That's people, just two people talking. But how it affects the people, that is a personal experience. That's a different thing. And how real it becomes to you is very different than how real it will come to somebody else. So therefore, that's a personal, suddenly you experience a new view that you're looking at life differently, that you see life differently. That is a personal experience, and that is where humility comes in. Explanation is the Hebrew word akev could mean because, Or it also means the heel. It also means a heel. And therefore, the second interpretation is that the heel of humility will trample the fear of the Lord. To be in total contradiction of the first half. And if humility is a good thing, how could it lead to such a catastrophic result that it destroys humility, it destroys the fear of God? By the heel, it means, the Rashi says that it tramples the fear of God. I will add that when it tramples, it takes the place of, humility takes the place of the fear of God. It will remove the fear of God. As you get humility, it will remove the fear of God. Torah in the literature, where they talk about either in the Torah itself or in the commentaries, the word Yiras Hashem, the fear of the Lord, has two meanings. One is its awe, which comes about as a result of your knowledge of the universe, like we said before, or knowledge of the physical world, knowledge of reality, shows you God. The other thing is that the fear of God is also a fear of God based upon, like, a religious emotion. Like, people are religious, either they're raised in religious homes or they become religious. So therefore, that term, the fear of God, is also used for that religious emotion. Okay? Now, that religious emotion is a good thing, because that religious emotion, well, if it gets you to study Torah and to keep the laws of Torah, so then it's a good thing. But, however, that's not the ultimate. The ultimate is to see God and to see religion via reality. And just studying about it is not enough, but you must have humility where the ideas that you study from Torah, the ideas that you see when you see them true, is that they become real to you. Then your view of God changes from the infantile view, from the emotional religious view, and it changes into a realistic view. And that's what I think Rashi means, that humility tramples the fear of God, because humility will help you see reality, make reality a part of you, and then the religious emotion will fall by the wayside, and it'll be replaced by a religious emotion that's a result of your knowledge. As if we put both interpretations together, we start out with a religious emotion and turn toward God because of the religious emotion. Then as we study, and that study becomes real to us, so then the ideas replace the religious emotion, and then as a result of that humility, then living the life of truth and studying truth, then you have an awe of God as a result of your knowledge, where you see, it's a result of seeing God's wisdom in the universe. But however, Rashi was not sure which one the verse was talking about. He wasn't sure if the verse was talking about the humility that removes the emotional view of religion, or was that part of humility which causes a person to stand in awe of God as a result of seeing the wisdom of God. Rashi doesn't explain the second half of the verse, but the Ibn Ezra does. And he says, as a result of your humility, you will have wealth, honor, and life. Okay? And he doesn't explain how, but I think that what he means is simple. When you start looking at life realistically, and you realize that everything takes a plan or some strategy on your part, if you need money, then you'll have the correct plan and strategy to make money. So that will help you become wealthy. Because you are a wise person and you do things correctly and thought out, people recognize that. They'll respect you for that. People respect a wise person. And life, many times life is shortened because first of all, physically we don't take care of it, but also the Ibn Ezra in many places says that conflict shortens your life, and today in modern science we're finding that to be true. And since the purpose of Torah, through the study of Torah, you will remove conflict, so therefore you will have a long life. However, a person does not work for these three things. It's a result of humility. In other words, humility is when you start seeing reality, and the purpose of humility, really, is to get the awe of God, to reach God. But however, once you have that humility, you will be successful practically also, because you'll just look at everything in a very practical way, and you'll not be driven by crazy emotions, and everything will be worked out according to plan and strategy, and therefore you will be successful. That's a result of humility, but the person of humility, his purpose is to really find God. What I talk about today is commitment. Commitment. And the question is, what does commitment mean? What does it mean to have a commitment? Okay? Commitment means whatever you're committed to. Let's say, for instance, you're committed to greed. Your whole framework in operating and all decisions that you make is always based around greed. In other words, there might be people that have greed, but they're not committed to greed. You see? Committed to greed means that their whole framework in which they operate is greed, and everything else is secondary to greed. And all their decisions and everything they say is basically based on greed. But there might be other people that have greed, but they're not committed to greed. Okay? So commitment means that it's the framework in which you operate. There are people, most people are not committed. Most people have a job, they're interested in their job, they're interested in their family, they're interested in their, they make, in other words, they're involved in many things, and many things are important, but it's not a commitment. Okay, commitment means that's the basis of my life. Now, what I want to say is that there are two ways that commitment comes about. One way is there's some emotion that is driving you. Some people are committed by some emotion, like a person has greed or something. But then there's the Torah view on commitment, okay, and how to become committed to Torah. Now, in other religions, they're committed to their religion by some feeling or some need, some emotional need for religion, whatever the emotion is, okay? But however, they're totally committed to that, and the whole framework in which they operate, and all their decisions are based upon their religion. In Judaism, a commitment, or according to Torah, the commitment comes about by thought. The commitment comes about by thought. And that thought is that there is no other life that is of any value in the physical world except the Torah life. And as you remove and recognize the failure of all the other types of life, so then you realize that the only type of life that's left is the life of Torah. And the way it's done is, from what I've seen, is in three ways. One is the approach of Proverbs, which shows you that if you do not live the life of Torah, then you will pay consequences. You will pay the consequences for it. Okay? That's the whole book of Proverbs. Okay? The second way is Ecclesiastes. And according to Rabbi Chait on his tape, he shows that there is no real satisfaction in anything that you're committed to, anything that you want to do. Of course, if you're not committed, definitely you will not have real satisfaction. But however, in your commitment, you will not find any real satisfaction except the life of Torah. Okay? So that's the second way of undoing the other ways of life, and as you undo the other ways of life rationally, so then you're committed to the Torah way of life. The third way is the dialogues of Plato, where he shows that other types of lives are irrational. He shows you the approach just to see that it doesn't make sense. And it's irrational, and therefore, if it's irrational, so therefore, it doesn't make sense, and therefore, you should not do it. You see? So therefore, there are three ways in which rationale dictates that you committed, that you become committed to the correct view of life. And that's by showing either contradictions to the other ways of life, showing consequences of living a life other than the Torah life, or showing that there's absolutely no psychological satisfaction to the other types of life except the life of Torah. Become committed not by some feeling or emotion towards Torah, but as the other areas become irrational and untenable to accept, either because of the consequences, or you see the consequences that it's impossible for you to live that life, or you see that there's no satisfaction. When the mind sees that, or even if the mind just sees that it's totally irrational, based on the contradiction, just doesn't make sense. Once the mind sees that, then it's impossible to follow from any one of these three ways. It's impossible to follow the irrational life. Therefore, you must follow the Torah life. Is before a person becomes committed, so why should he want to do either way? Let's say, for instance, other religion and the life of Torah, right? Now, other religions say, look, you work with religion, you become part of our religion, and then you'll see in a year or two you'll become committed just by living the life, right? Now, the thing is what they're saying, that even though, in other words, let's say I would tell you, well, I say the life of drugs, living a life of drugs is a good life. Just try it and you'll see. You see?
You'll become committed.
You'll become committed, right? You'll become committed to drugs, you'll see. Your whole life will be decided by drugs. All your decisions will be based around drugs. Mm-hmm. Now, definitely, you would say that's irrational. In other words, first you should find out what drugs are before you commit yourself. And if there are any consequences, whether it's a good or a harm or an evil, you see? Now, before I commit myself to another religion, I should first analyze and see if it's of any value, if it's of any value to, or there's only consequences. Now, we say the same thing with Torah. We say that when you come to Torah, don't commit yourself. But, however, study the ideas of Torah and see why the other paths are incorrect. And as your mind sees, without a commitment, but you're interested in what is the best life, you're searching, so as your mind sees that there are incorrect, the other approaches, the other religions are incorrect, and other lifestyles are incorrect, as you start seeing that more and more, then you become more and more committed to Torah. You see? In other words, in other religions, what they say is become committed, and then you'll see it's good. In Torah, we don't say that. We say study and see the incorrectness of the other ways, and then you will see the correctness of Torah, then you will become committed by virtue of your mind seeing the truth. As people start out with their emotions, different emotions. Some people start out with religious emotions or different religions or a non-religious emotion. But all we're asking is not to commit to Judaism, but just to make an investigation of Torah. To investigate. We say if you make a true investigation and you see the inconsistencies and consequences and lack of satisfaction in any other lifestyle, then you will have to be committed to the life of Torah. You must start out uncommitted, because we hold that you should not commit yourself emotionally, because that's irrational. Like a person would say, well, commit yourself to drugs, and you'll see that you'll be committed. Can't do that. You have to think about it, whether you should be committed. It's only after your mind sees the truth, then naturally you will be committed, because there's nothing else left. After you show that every other lifestyle in the world is inconsistent, So then, by definition, you will be committed to the life of Torah. Is that that many times people can study the the life of Torah and show the inconsistencies of the other life, the other lifestyles, and yet they don't become totally committed. Okay, the answer is that it takes a very long time to be totally committed. Two is that you have to understand there might be psychological factors that stop you from being committed. It might be, so one answer is that you might need a longer period of time of study before you commit it. Secondly, there are certain psychological things that might stop you from being committed. You have to find that out before you can be committed. You have to undo that before you can be committed. And thirdly, besides that, there are certain people that can't, in other words, their ability to reroute their energy to a different lifestyle is not complete. They can't do it. It's not humanly possible. In other words, your ability to change lifestyle, everybody has a different ability. Some people could totally move away from their lifestyle and go into the lifestyle of Torah. Some people could go partially into the lifestyle of Torah. You see? So each person has to go according to his ability, how far he could go. That's all you could do. That's your responsibility. But however, you'll need an outlet in the other area, so you should make sure when you have an outlet in the other area that you are still attached to make sure that it is done in such a way that there's no harm to you, no consequences, and it doesn't pull you into the pull you away from Torah. Sometimes you have to give up certain things because certain emotions, the involvement, if you get involved in certain things, it can pull you away from the life of Torah. Then you can't have an outlet for that. But however, a person should have an outlet for the emotions that there's no consequence and that it doesn't pull them away from Torah. Then they should have an outlet in their old lifestyle until through the study of Torah they become committed and they go as far as they can go. I'll put it this way. In other words, a person should not make a fanatical change in his lifestyle, but it should come as fast as his knowledge permits him and as fast as his emotions permit him to turn from one lifestyle to another lifestyle. As much as his emotions allow him, but he shouldn't force himself faster than that. Okay, it should be guided by these ideas of Torah.